Blog Talk Radio.
Law of Attraction Talk Radio. Get ready to be the best you can be. Stay tuned for the Law of Attraction Talk Radio with Jules.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful, balmy Southern California. And tonight we have Jeff Brown with us from Ontario, Canada. And he's going to be sharing some wonderful insights with us from his book, Soul Shaping, An Adventure in Self-Creation. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? And he's going to be coming up in just a few moments. I have a feeling this is going to be an absolutely outstanding show tonight. You know, I'm already on a terrific high because I had the Law of Attraction workshop today. I met some really, really, really incredible people, and we got to mix our energy. And, you know, it's just wonderful creating a beautiful tomorrow. It's just magnificent. There's nothing more exciting than feeling the energy of creation. I love it. So anyway, sit back, raise your vibration up, and listen to Jeff Brown right after we listen to our wonderful sponsor, the Science of Getting Rich program. People love this when it happens. They like to hear my laugh because it didn't work. Again, technical difficulties, so I will go back and put it back in. You know, things just work out so much sometimes. Too much high. There we go.
Would you like to seize the wealth manifesting power of the Law of Attraction right now? You can, with the exciting new course now being taught by teachers featured in the best-selling hit movie, The Secret, including Bob Proctor and Jack Canfield, creator of the phenomenal Chicken Soup for the Soul series. Go to financialrealities.net now to receive 7 lessons absolutely free. That's financialrealities.net. Make 2008 the year you turn your financial fantasies into a rich reality.
Now watch it play a second time.
Maybe it's meant to.
No, I guess it's going to work. There must have been a delay on it. But any case, everything works out perfectly. Listen, we've got some really, really great things coming up on Law of Attraction Talk Radio, and I just want to mention a few. Next Thursday, we're having another special broadcast with the inventor of Awake 2000 Mind Master System, Mr. Vern Hall. For those of you who are interested in self-hypnosis and positive affirmations, you're going to want to tune into the show because it's going to give you some really incredible equipment, techniques that you're going to be able to live more positively. And next Sunday, our guest is Jacqueline Lloyd, who is a world-renowned metaphysical teacher, and she has written a wonderful novel about the first woman president. So we're going to be tapping into her head and even talking about our national politics right now and how we will want to look at our current world situation. Anyway, it's going to be interesting. People always love it when we focus in on what's happening today, so it's going to be a great show. And then on June 1st, we have David Wilcox, who you will know as Edgar Casey Incarnate. He's going to be back with us. David is one of the most brilliant men I have ever had the pleasure of talking with, so you're going to find this interview extremely thought-provoking. And also we have coming up Dr. Jill Bolt Taylor. Now, you may have seen a video that is running rampant on YouTube about Dr. Taylor. She is a brain scientist, and she describes in details her thoughts, motions, and physical occurrence while she is having a major, major stroke. It's one of the most incredible stories that you will ever hear. It's incredible, incredibly spiritual, and inspiring. I mean, truly, as a brain scientist, she has discovered the spiritual link for us all, and it is something you're not going to want to miss. We also have Story Watchers coming back on, and Lee Harris is coming back on. We have Dr. Bruce Limpton, and we have Dr. Bernie Siegel, and they're going to be coming on in August. So keep on tuning in to Law of Attraction Talk Radio, where we provide the guests that's going to help you on your delightful journey into the Law of Attraction. So, now, let's get started on tonight's show. Jeff Brown lives in Ontario, Canada, and has written an incredible book called Soul Shaping and Venture in Self-Creation, which is the story of a man's struggle to identify and honor his inner conflict while navigating through his misidentification of emotional issues. A criminal attorney by trade, Jeff decided to forego the prestige and the financial security of his own law office in search of his truth and his mission as to why he's here on Earth. I just think it's wonderful. Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for being on Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Let's get started,
okay. Because
you've got so much fabulous information to share here. Tell me about soul shaping. What exactly does that mean, and what's the message you're trying to convey to the reader?
Well, I think there are a lot of parts to it. Soul shaping for me fundamentally meant that at some point on my journey, I recognized that I was here to transform my soul's consciousness in its march towards wholeness, that there was work to be done in this lifetime. I had experiences, lessons, and various things that I had to convert into the learning that I needed to expand my soul. And for a long time, I thought it was really a simple question of just uncovering or excavating my callings and my lessons and my learnings, and that somehow the universe would do the rest. And at some point in the journey, I realized when I had uncovered the next step in my path that there was work to be done. So I ultimately came to believe that soul shaping was some combination of free will and determinism. We do the work to uncover why we're here, and then we do the work to both authenticate and actualize those callings so we can become the next being on our march towards wholeness.
Wow, very well put. Wow. So you were a criminal attorney. That's what you went to school for, and you just felt this calling to go out and write a book?
Yeah, it started with like a little nudge, more than a calling. It was like, I called it in the book, a distant flute. Even before I articled, which in Canada you have to apprentice for a year to become a criminal lawyer, mm-hmm. even before that year, there were a number of different signs or indications that my path was to go in a different direction after apprenticing. When I was a young kid, I used to see this guy, Eddie Greenspan, on television in Canada. He was a famous criminal lawyer here, and I knew that I knew him. I felt very closely connected to him and felt like he was part of my innate image. I didn't have the words for it at that time, but he was so fundamental to me, and I used to say, I'm going to work with that guy. And then eventually I did work for him, and just before my apprenticeship year with him, I had a number of experiences. Like I would, you know, be selling windows, for example. I had a student business, and I was driving out to the subdivisions, I used to hear this kind of voice inside of my head that said, "You are not the man you appear to be." And I remember I would go, you know, I would sell windows. I would get all pumped up and kind of egoic to make money, and I would always go in the Johnny on the job just beforehand for a moment, and I would have this dialogue with this part of me that I identified later as my inner daemon. And I would say, you know, I promise I will be back. I will get back onto the path that I'm supposed to walk. But for the moment, I have to go and survive. And as time went by, this distant flute or this little voice, which I ultimately named Little Missy, grew stronger until eventually I had no choice but to listen to it.
So you just brought in Little Missy, and you've got to explain Little Missy to our listeners here.
I think, you know, my path when I was young, it seemed like my path was primarily a traditionally male warrior path, the trial lawyer path. And this little voice inside of me would appear, and the warrior self that I identified myself as would dialogue with this part of me. And initially, the warrior self called this part of me Little Missy in a disparaging way, like kind of like when John Wayne would open the door for Little Missy, like Little Missy was somehow weaker, smaller, and unable to open the door for herself.
Right.
And ultimately, Little Missy grew quite powerful, and these dialogues became an organic part of my inner narrative, the part of me telling me to join the world, to take the egoic path, to become a prominent trial lawyer, and then the part of me that kept beckoning me towards the place of not knowing, the next step in my journey. And that dialogue went on for many, many years, and I think probably 15 years, until eventually they both became absorbed into me, and I now pretty much have a hard time distinguishing the two.
Wow. Wow. Well, so you talk about the male warrior or the armored warrior. As you said, you went through a lot of stages of unpeeling, what you called clearing the debris to get to a point of surrender, which I agree is the most important place to be. What advice would you give men who are struggling to open up their hearts?
I think one of the things that I would tell them, I think the male warrior is fundamentally oriented towards a more focused or directed place. And I think that the first step in the journey for me, I think clearing the debris was the initial step because I had a lot of emotions that I was holding and they had to be moved out of me. But I think for a lot of men, the first thing that they can do, I don't know that they're going to be ready for that kind of intense release. I didn't have much of a choice, but it's just to learn to sit in the place of not knowing. And this is a very, very difficult thing for the warrior, but I think that this is essential to the journey. If we can't sit in the not knowing, if we can't befriend our confusion and live in the question, it's very difficult for us to become intimate with those parts of ourselves that want to be expressed. And I think that would be the first thing I would tell them, is to learn how to slow down, be present with that which they don't know, and to become aware, consciously aware, of how they direct themselves, how they focus themselves, how they pull out of not knowing, and to try to find various ways to pull back into the not knowing. So that's the first thing I would say. And I think the next thing I would say is that they really do have to, when they're ready for it, begin to do work to peel away the armor. And I think that that's a physical experience that can involve massage, for example, or the right yoga practice, the practice that suits their body, and also doing the emotional work that many of us as men are very, very uncomfortable doing. I mean, I think that if we don't create space in the inner tunnel, if we don't open up enough space so that we can achieve some kind of clarity, our spiritual path has a real hard time emerging and showing itself, you know, because we're basically just kind of spun out in our kind of our repetitive framework of perception, that which we know best. And I think men have to start to get acquainted with something that they don't know very well.
So as part of the male war, let's give something that they can, the men and the women, because I have a feeling that this still applies to women as well. Let's give them how they can identify, like, how would a man be struggling to open, at what point would they be struggling? If they're having a relationship problem, or if they're having a career decision, or, you know, something like what you did. I mean, you wanted to be a writer instead of really being an attorney. Is that correct? Is that what got you into the struggle, or for you to realize that you had to start peeling some of layers off?
I was just about to sign on the dotted line and start a law practice after my apprenticeship year, and I just had a nudging feeling that I shouldn't do it. And it wasn't concrete or tangible. You know, I called it a spiritual emergency in the book, and I think that's what it was. I mean, it was like a dark night of the soul. There was profound chaos and conflict happening inside of me when I was about to make that particular move. Little Missy got real active. Like, I could hear myself. There was like a narrative of don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Now, I didn't know what was next. I had had indications that psychology and writing were inherent in my innate image as well earlier in my life. But really, there was so much family material in the way that I really couldn't bring that distant flute a whole lot closer. I don't think it always happens that there's some clear hit as to where you're supposed to walk next. Usually there isn't. And really, we just have to find some faith that the voice that tells us not to take a particular step is wise. And that's, I mean, that was the hardest thing in the world for me to do, because I came from nothing, and I was just determined, eager, you know, to take care of my family, to raise them up from the survivalist structures that we'd grown up with. And my ego, after, you know, I had a real fractured experience in my early life, I was just, part of me was so delighted at the idea of being identified as a lawyer, a trial lawyer, a good trial lawyer. And it was really, really hard to trust a voice that really was very hazy, noisy but hazy for the most part. And I don't think there's any, you know, definitive, simplistic message to give to men about this. I think they have to do work on a lot of different levels to be able to hear the voice and to honor it. You know, it's like, it's a real steady and slow process, I think.
Well, but how do you get to the point where you can actually go a different direction? How do you start trusting that voice? How do you start trusting, like, little Missy is really, you know, a viable mm-hmm. voice?
Well, I think one thing you do is you get into therapy.
Ah.
And you begin to develop your consciousness around your emotional patterns and issues. I think that's a helpful thing. I think you try to do some body-centered therapeutic work so you can actually do some emotional release work, so clear some space inside. I think that's another step that you can take. You know, I think for me, the first part of the journey was identifying who I wasn't. And mm-hmm. I wasn't the trial lawyer. And that was my focus. Who am I not? Because I wasn't going to be able to figure out who I wasn't and who I was both at the same time. And then after I knew and I made the decision and it was solid enough in me, just solid enough that I knew I wasn't going to do trial law, then I started to do what I call depth charges, which was I went out and had experiences that were intended to excavate who lived inside of me, who I in fact was in this life. And, you know, I went to like Jack Kornfield and Stan Grof Insight and Opening workshops, and I had one experience there that was remarkable. I did workshops at Omega and Rhinebeck. I did holotropic breath work to try to bring up who I was on the wave of the breath. I mean, I think you have to have those. I had to have those kind of experiences because I didn't have a real clear and definitive hit.
Interesting.
But it's, you know, I think it's incremental. I mean, I think that as much as it's always exciting to talk about, you know, just being positive and finding your way to it that way, for me, three steps forward, two steps back is progress. And, you know, I step back a lot. I mean, I would make little movements and then I would step back and have to push myself forward again. I mean, you know, it takes time. It takes time to get from misidentification to true path in an adapted world, in a culture that's basically gripping at the roots. Survivalism is still everywhere. I mean, it's complicated.
But you have reached your place where you feel comfortable now.
Yeah, I do. I feel comfortable. I don't long for he who waits on the other side the way that I used to.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's great.
So that's today, right?
Yeah.
Who's next, right? I mean, I may start longing for who's next soon, but right now I'm real good with where I am and it feels really right. And even when things are really overwhelming, you know, in my day, I still feel different than I used to when things were overwhelming because I've chosen this overwhelm. It's connected to the path that I'm on. And so, yeah, it feels a whole lot better than it did. I mean, if I was practicing law right now, I would be incredibly uncomfortable in my own skin, I think.
Good. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
You wrote about enlightenment as something different from our usual notions of enlightenment. Tell us what you meant by that.
I think for me, it's initially I kind of had this idea that I was going for bliss, you know, and that it was always going to be bliss. I was just going to get real joyous, and I was going to bounce along the path like that. And as my path developed, it became clear to me that that wasn't it, that really for me the most inclusive or heightened consciousness I could hope for was one that was just more authentic, which meant that I was more deeply here, like be real now, like I was really here And here meant that I was available to every part of the human experience, joy and pain and shadow and light and grocery list and unity consciousness, like all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And for me, that just makes a whole lot more sense. Like for example, if you reach a certain stage in the path and like a very close friend dies, you want to be able to feel the pain of that. You want to be able to go through the stages of grieving. And I think if you were just bliss focused, you would find a way to kind of bypass those feelings. And I don't think that would be a very heightened consciousness, right?
Right.
Yeah. So
because,
it's just like,
because every feeling is valid.
It's all part of it, you know. And I think a lot of us who had difficult childhoods, our struggle in our therapeutic work is to get back to, I mean, it's, you know, we certainly want more joy in our lives, but we also want to just be more present in our bodies for everything. Like, you know, when you're a kid and there's too much trauma, you shut off the pain pathway mm-hmm. with various distractive techniques and various things. And so, but ultimately you want to be able to come back into life and back into relationship and feel everything again. But at least know as an adult you're solid enough and clarified enough that you know that it's not going to kill you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're here for all of it.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's okay, you know. It's okay. It's okay. Like today I was walking down the street and I saw another homeless person in the neighborhood who I had wanted to give books to, something we can talk about a little later, but because
yeah.
there's a fella in Toronto selling my book off the streets of Toronto, a homeless guy. And I knew that I couldn't give this person these books. It was just not really going to work out. And I felt sad for her. You know, I've been kind of connected to her on the streets over a number of years. And that felt, you know, just really healthy to be able to feel that sadness or disappointment as part of a more inclusive consciousness.
Mm, good point. Yeah, I do want to touch base on your homelessness thing because you've got a fantastic thing going on. But before we get to that, let's talk about one of the key strands in your book is the relationship between the emotions and the spiritual body. Where some models seem to suggest that heightened consciousness only comes through detaching from our person, you seem to say the opposite.
Right.
Is that right?
I'm not really. Like, I understand the value of detachment. I think it's essential to get us out of, like, a localized lens, to get
mm-hmm.
us out of a narrow framework, and to see ourselves in a bigger way. So I think, I mean, it certainly helped me on my path, but I mean, I think at some point we have to come back down into our bodies and bring our emotional life and our spiritual life together. I don't make any distinction between them. And maybe this is an odd perspective, particularly nowadays, but for me, I needed to find a model that would allow me to I kind of linked my pain, the pain I was holding in my body, with my spiritual path, with my soul shaping. So I say repressed emotions are unactualized spiritual lessons. It's the idea that we need to get into our feelings, see them all the way through to the lessons that they contain, because we come in with an innate image for this lifetime, particular lessons, learnings, and experiences that we need to go through in order to expand our soul. If we don't come down into our bodies, if we don't come down into the feelings that we're holding in our bodies, how do we transform our soul's consciousness? And I don't really know that we can. And I think it's real tempting to imagine that the best way to get to a spiritual place is to get out of our bodies, because our bodies are often the bodies of pain. But for me, that didn't ultimately work. It gave me a glimpse, but it wasn't enough.
Hmm.
I started to feel detached and disconnected. And, you know, like, I'm a God is in the people kind of guy. Like, for me, that's my thing. It's like, somehow, this body wasn't a mistake. My mother wasn't a mistake. My personhood wasn't a mistake. So it's this idea that we have to convert all that we are on a personal level in order to ascend spiritually. I also think we have to get down into our bodies and clear the emotional material so that we can be present for our spiritual life. I mean, even on the most basic level, I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do me a favor, define spiritual life. That's a hard one, I know, but what does that mean?
I don't know. I just think spirituality means reality. You know, I've always just, it's just like the more spiritual I am, you know, it's back to this notion of enrealment, like the more spiritual I am, the more reality-based I am, the more I'm in the moment on all kinds of different levels. So when I think of somebody, you know, when someone says to me she's really spiritual, it just means that she's kind of more here than somebody else is. You know, that's really all it means to me, just being deeply present in every respect.
Deeply present, but are they connected to others? I mean, spiritual would mean that they're more loving, or they're seeing people as equals. I mean, what does that's just reality. I mean, some people see reality as being, you know, a difficult situation.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I see it, if I understand the question, like I see reality as being more in reality as including my connection to others quite deeply, you know? I mean, I think we come in each life, each soul comes in to honor its particular innate image or pathways, soul scriptures for this lifetime, but those pathways include the other. I mean, we can't learn without each other, and you know, it's complicated, right? It's like with the situation with the homeless guy. I see how complicated it is. But for the grace of God, there go I. Well, that's deeply true for me. But at some point, he's also not me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is complicated to figure out the distinction between those two things. But, I think deeply spiritual means deeply connected in all respects, which includes connected to others.
Hmm. Wow. So what is your vision of the relationship between emotional healing and spiritual growth then?
I don't think we can grow spiritually if we don't do our emotional healing. I don't make any distinction between the two.
Good.
Yeah, I don't. I don't understand. I mean, how do you feel about that?
No, I agree with you. You have to have both. It's very, very important. Because it has to do with the belief, or your beliefs. So you've sort of got to rewire the beliefs in order to heal emotionally and therefore have spiritual growth. You have to have that. I think your book spells it out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if there's a message in the book, it's that it's to try to bring it all together, you know, to try to bring our spiritual journey through our heart. I mean, not as a conceptual thing, but actually as an experiential thing. And it's difficult because depending on how much trauma we have and depending on what resources we have, it's not always easy to work through all that material, you know. And I don't know that we have to work through all of it. I think Ram Dass was the one who said, the goal is not to be free of suffering, but to be free with suffering, you know. It's just to do enough work to create enough space in the tunnel that we can begin to live a more authentic life, right?
Right. Very good. Yeah. Well, a forgiveness then plays a major role in the healing, right?
Yes, I think often it does, but I think it's tricky, you know, and I think we have to be careful what we mean when we talk about forgiveness. You know, the whole New Age mantra around forgiveness, forgiveness, forgiveness. So somebody says, well, like, I forgive my father for what he did, but you can feel the rage emanating from their body. I don't think that that's the kind of forgiveness we should be after. I think we need to go for some kind of authentic forgiveness. And I know on my journey, I tried for like a long time to forgive things from that place. You know, like I wanted to sort of bypass the core material, and it didn't really work, you know. I mean, I would be like, when I was, did say, like, I was upset with my father, when I didn't see him, it seemed quite easy to tell myself I'd forgiven him until he was in the room, and then it was clear that I hadn't forgiven him yet. And I went to Connecticut and worked with Alexander Lowen, the bioenergetic founder, and we did some work around my mother. You know, he gave me a red towel and he told me to squeeze it. And he said, you know, kill your mother. And what, you know, and I resisted. And then I did it. And after that experience, I felt so, so much closer to a genuinely forgive, like I had genuinely forgiven so much of what had happened, because he had encouraged me and I had allowed myself to see my feelings through to some form of completion, you know. Whereas before that, when I hadn't gone that deeply into those feelings, I think it was inauthentic, the kind of forgiveness I thought I was experiencing.
Yeah, sidestepping it, the deep onion peeling, interesting. Well, so forgiveness as a premature forgiveness, then, is, and real forgiveness. I mean, there's different kinds of forgiveness, but you have to get down deep, and that takes time. It's just not saying it. It's going in and really peeling the onions. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, like see it through so that when you talk about forgiving somebody, you really mean it. Like you really feel it, you know?
And
you know,
does
go
that
for
have,
it.
Does that have to do with forgiving yourself for the thoughts that you had about your mom?
No, I think the thoughts were right on. No. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I find this very tricky. I'm not always real clear about it. I find this whole notion tricky. You know, it was clearer after a while, but not always. You know, I don't think that I think my thoughts emanated from my experiences, which were for a long time unresolved, and that when I saw the feelings through, those kind of thoughts, many of those kinds of thoughts just organically disappeared. And then, but I never felt guilty about the thoughts at all. You know, I think they're there for a reason. And instead of sort of beating ourselves up for having this nasty thought, let's get into why we have that nasty thought. What are we holding that hasn't been moved that holds us to that thought, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, very good. One of my favorite lines from the book is, if you have one foot in the past and one foot in the future, you're pissing all over the present. Now, I got to tell you, I've used that plenty of times in my life. That key phrase, I just love that. It really says a lot. Tell us what you mean by that. And specifically, tell me what you meant, what it meant to you on your journey.
I don't know. I think, like, I had, before, not to say that everything's been resolved, but before I had resolved enough to sort of move forward in a good way, I've had one foot in the old material, like the power of then, right? I mean, wherever you stop along the way on the path on an emotional level, you know, even though you may chronologically move forward, you're still consciously kind of, your consciousness is back there. And so I think I always had one foot in that anger, and I had one foot in that old unresolved grief. There was no space in my childhood to move through all that material. I was just adapting and disguising myself and trying to survive. But so I think that was the left foot, and the right foot was really primarily in my anxiety about money, economic reality. And it was certainly past focus. Like it had, I named that part of myself the huckster, the part that motivated me to finally make money and pull myself out of a poverty consciousness. But I had a lot of early trauma around money. I mean, I think we lived in 16 houses or something like that in my early life, or something like that. And so I that part of me, that worry about tomorrow, as well as the unresolved pain from before, were so took up so much space inside of me that there was no room to be here. I couldn't really be here. I didn't know what here was. Here was then, and here was what about tomorrow, you know. And I think that you have to work through enough of the past holdings and enough of the future anxiety so that you settle down enough inside that so you can actually settle into the moment finally. That took a long time, though. You know, and it's an ongoing process. It's not a completed process, but
That's really good. How did you, though, prevent yourself from being in the present? And I think this is such a common problem with everybody. How did you recognize it? How did you prevent yourself from being in the present?
Well, I think the thoughts are part of it. You know, the monkey mind is busy. I mean, I think that's a habit, and it's also a way we avoid reality. And, you know, I was a master of the art of distraction. I really was. You know, I mean, to me, it's like, why you do something is more important than what you do. So, like, if you rent videos, like, to relax, it's okay. But if you rent videos to get away from something you don't want to feel, then you're just self-distracting. And I went to the racetrack. I slept with women I didn't love. I got hooked into all kinds of relationship dramas that, on some level, reflected the chaos of my early life, but I think they also helped me to avoid the moment, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, intensity is a wonderful way to avoid reality. I mean, you just stay stirred up and, I mean, caffeinated and agitated and conflicted and, you know, and sometimes those things were just real and really reflective of unresolved stuff, but sometimes it was just a way of not settling into myself and feeling myself, you know?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, it's kind of like being a drama queen. You know, you get so addicted to all that drama going on, but what you're really doing is escaping the basics of
right.
you,
exactly.
the inner
like,
self of you.
Like, what does it feel like to just sit with you? And, you know, it's like I had this one relationship I remember, and we would, like, fight all the time. And I remember sometimes, so she'd, like, then she'd go, and this was the thing. Then I'd be on my own. And I used to remember I would sit down on the couch, and sometimes I would start to feel who lived inside of me. And it was uncomfortable. I didn't know him very well, and he was hurt. And so I would pick up the phone, and we'd go at it again. We'd get right back into conflict. It was wonderful. You know,
oh yeah,
it was wonderful for her. I mean, she was probably doing the exact same thing that I was doing, which was just trying to avoid sitting still, being alone, feeling isolated. You know, it was like the illusion of connection, too, right? You know?
Yeah. You're definitely a vibrational match to the person that keeps you
right.
going in the drama. That's for sure.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
You write and now blog about the importance of befriending your confusion and sitting in a place of not knowing on the path. Why is this essential to the journey of unfolding? Why do we have such a hard time with this?
I think in Western culture, there's a lot of energy around focus, and this is probably how the world is. We've pulled ourselves out of a little farther away from survivalism. We've put on a tie and a suit, and we've focused, and we've gotten to work. And you know, there are good things. There are good things about that. But you know, I think that you know, for most of us, who we identify ourselves as is primarily a function of who we've been told we are, or our adaptations and disguises. You know, like how we've survived in this world and gotten through our day. And that's often a dramatically different thing from who we really are. So how do we get from who we identify ourselves as, if it doesn't feel true, to who we really are? And I think primarily we have to learn how to sit in the place of not knowing, because how else will it ever rise up to speak to us? I mean, it's hard to hear the voice of your callings when you're focused, when you're adapted, when you're a pumped up salesperson. Or you're like the nurse, and that's who you identify yourself as, whatever it happens to be. I mean, how do you hear the other voices if you don't slow down enough to listen in? You know,
absolutely.
I mean, little Missy pushed her way through. She pushed her way through my walls, but not enough. If I hadn't sat in that horrible discomfort of living in my, just sitting in my own skin, not knowing, befriending my confusion, just getting acquainted with this kind of mess inside of me. If I hadn't done that, her voice never would have gotten strong enough to tell me what path to ultimately walk, you know? And I think it's real hard because we have, you know, there's a lot of messaging about being flaky, right? We hear a lot of it on the West Coast, right? You know, about like just kind of stumbling around like a confused hippie, you know. And, you know, of course, that can be really ungrounded and not get anywhere, but it can also be really important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of the time I spent on the West Coast being confused was the most important time for my path. Because somewhere in the heart of that not knowing, a little voice like at Harbin Hot Springs came up and said, it's time to write the book, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to write the book. And if I was in the middle of the courtroom, you know, or if I was in my egoic focus, or I was like the warrior male who knew everything, you know, I mean, I wouldn't have heard that. I wouldn't have written the book.
Yeah, and it's true, out of that profound pain, it often gives you the opportunity in which to change. And I think that's, everything is a great opportunity. But you had a profound experience with Ram Dass.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. I know that has to do with the ascending with both feet on the ground, right?
Right.
What is that? It really is fascinating.
Well, like, I think writing the book was this journey, you know. It's like I knew I had to write it, but I grew in the heart of writing it. And I think one of the concepts that appeared to me early in the journey was this notion of ascending with both feet on the ground. You know, like from soul to soul, S-O-L-E to S-O-U-L. Like really this idea of going down into the body again to go up. You know, I had a lot of issues around my root chakra and so on, so... You know, if I didn't do work around my root chakra and all my anxiety about, like, moving and homelessness and all this kind of stuff, you know, I couldn't have moved forward. So these were kind of the themes that were moving through me as I was writing. And towards the end of the writing, I've been producing a film about a guy named Bhagavan Dass called Carmageddon. And I went to Maui to interview Ram Dass for parts of a couple of days for the movie, because Bhagavan Dass was the fellow that had brought Ram Dass to Neem Karoli Baba, so they're inextricably linked to each other. And when I was with him, I was really at this moment of just starting to put to words what I meant by ascending with both feet on the ground. And being around a lot of chanters, I was really getting kind of tripped out. I was like getting really into their bliss thing and not really understanding again what grounded spirituality was. So when I was with him, there was just this moment. There were many moments, but there was one particular moment when he was looking outside at the birds on the feeder, you know, and he'd had a stroke, so he's moving at a much more, you know, he's much more present, very subtly connected to the moment. And in his eyes were kind of moist, like he was really feeling connected to his body and feeling really connected to those birds, to the moment. And just, I don't know, somehow it all came together, this kind of Eastern notion or quest for oneness, the Western quest for emotional health, and it was like I had a deeper understanding of what ascending with both feet on the ground meant to me. And it really just meant a form of spirituality that was deeply connected to our hearts.
Oh, I love it. That is fantastic.
Yeah, and I think that's where he is now. You know, I think he wrote about Be Here Now to remind himself to be here now, like we all do, right? And I think he's here now much more deeply, and I think the key was coming right down in and moving outward from his open heart, which is really quite beautiful.
Wow. Wow. That is well said. I love it. Let's move into the homelessness. And tell people about that video that you just put out on YouTube. That is really terrific story, and I really think that you are impacting the world by this whole concept. So why don't you go ahead and tell us about it?
Yeah, there was this guy Slim, who's a homeless guy in Toronto, and I used to talk to him when I was writing the book. He was just interesting. This notion of like what is homelessness again, right? And because he had this glint in his eye, and he was really heartfelt guy. And I remember I'd be like sitting talking to him, and he had like a big giant push cart with all these things hanging off it, and people would walk by with their coffee cups, you know, on their way to work, and none of them looked as brightly lit as him, you know. So it was interesting. It was just tweaked my inquiries around what homelessness meant. And then I included him in the gratitude section of the book after it was published, and then a little while ago, we got to talking. He hangs out at the Starbucks near my house, and somehow it came up, this idea that he would sell soul shaping off the street. And at first, it seemed like preposterous to me. It just was a paradigm shift, or I don't know what it was, but it didn't make any sense to me. Because, of course, he's homeless, and homeless people don't want to work in all those illusions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I went and I got him some books, and I left, and I came back the next morning, and they'd been sold. And then he placed an official order, like a distributor, of 11 more books, and I went home and got them. And I came back later the day three were gone, and I came back the next day they were gone. And now he was really focused. You know, now he was going to get a special cart, and he was going to put signs all over it, and he wanted me to get shirts that said, you know, he's got one that says, buy a great self-help book here, and, you know, whatever. He directs me, I get the stuff, and he wears it. He's, you know, yeah, he's pretty powerful dude. But
wow.
So then as it unfolded, we initiated a homelessness challenge on Facebook. There's a Homelessness Challenge 2008 group to invite other people who are in a position to do so to try to do something for a homeless person in the neighborhood to empower them and to bring them back into the world of connectedness. I mean, it can be an errand. It can be wash my car. It can be anything that makes them feel like they're part of the world again, that they're needed for their gifts rather than just handing them money, which sometimes is necessary, but isn't always all that they need, right?
Right.
Right. And so we put out a guy named Chris Telfer from Toronto Media Labs came and he shot something on an afternoon a few weeks ago, and it's up on YouTube. I think you just do a search for Jeff Brown homelessness, and it comes up on his section. There's a part one and a part two that should be up soon, and it just tells the story. And Slim is interviewed more in part two of the video, and as it's unfolded, he now has his push cart lined up. He's got the signs all over the sides of it. He's got the shirts, and he's leaving the neighborhood. I let him use my shed, and he puts his bigger cart in my backyard. And every day he just wakes up in the morning, and he's got a reason to wake up in the morning now. And he gets his little cart, and he just walks 3 miles down to certain streets in downtown Toronto and sells soul shaping off the street.
Isn't that something? Isn't that just magnificent?
Yeah, and you know, and the best of it was, a few weeks ago, I'd walked down St. Clair Avenue, just a street in Toronto, and I'd looked to the right, and there's a, like, takeout chicken place, and I looked in it, and there was a black guy there, and he was, like, so excited. He was, like, a happy, happy guy. And at first, I didn't realize it was Slim, right?
Uh-huh.
And then Slim came out, and my buddy was with me and said, Slim, I want to buy a book, you know, and Slim got all excited. He said, oh, I sold out today, Jeff, I sold out today. And I don't think I've ever seen a human being look more ecstatic. And then his smile went away for a second, and I knew why. It was like he was afraid, you know, it would be taken away from him. So I said, don't worry, Slim, nobody's going to take it away from you. You don't have to worry about it. And then he lit up, and it was just, we were both, you know, we were super touched. It was just, because it took so little energy on my part to make that much of a difference. That's what's interesting about it. It's nothing to hand over a few books. It's nothing to say, I've got a few errands for you to do. You know, it's nothing, and what a profound effect it had on that other person, you know?
What a profound effect. That is wonderful. Not only did you give him a power to improve his life, but you gave him the power to go out and empower somebody else through your book.
Mm-hmm. And
so
people have come to him.
And
people have come to him. They're excited about it. They've bought the book. They like the book. They come back and buy a few more books. Rick LeBlanc brought 3 or 4 more books. They just come back to him, and they write me emails and tell me their story of their experience, how wonderful it felt for them to buy from him. And it doesn't hurt that they enjoy the book as well. And then they come back and buy more. And so it's like everybody wins. I love it because the book moves more strongly into the world. He loves it. And everybody, it's just a win-win for everybody. It's really a rare experience. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it does... doesn't have to be a book. It can be anything. What do you suggest for other people? What can we do for other homeless people here? How can we empower them?
You know, I think we could. You can start with little errands. You know, you can start with just some things that you're having a real busy week that you can't get to. You see if you can identify a homeless person in your neighborhood that you feel comfortable enough talking to.
Mm-hmm.
Or that you might have someone you know feel comfortable, maybe send somebody else to talk to them, who you feel more comfortable talking to them. And maybe you give them 3 or 4 small things to do, you know, to pick up for you from the store. Maybe you start with a small amount of money if you're worried they're going to take your money. You know, you start with $10 or $15 worth of stuff, and then, you know, and then you see what happens. You just see what happens, you know.
Wow.
Something like that. They can wash your car. They can work on your property if you have a property, you know.
So what we need to do in order to empower somebody else is that we've actually got to get over our fear or of being able to help somebody, right?
We got to get over our fear of them and what we identify the homeless to be. But I think we also have to deal with our own fear of our own homelessness. You know, I think for a lot of us, one of the reasons we shun the homeless is because we have our own fear that that will happen to us is pretty close to the surface of our consciousness.
Oh, yeah.
You know, how many times a day do most of us worry about ending up with nothing? A lot of us think about it a lot of the time. And I think that homeless person becomes a symbol of that which we fear, and I think we have to do some work around that.
Brilliant. Wow.
And we have to get into unity consciousness, like this idea of allness that we talk about now. Like, what does it really mean? I mean, it's a concept, but what does it really, really mean? It means that we bring everyone back into the fold. In Western culture, for God's sakes, we got enough money now to bring everybody back into the fold. I mean, it's one thing to talk about a culture that has nothing, is starting from basic needs level. That's more complicated. But in this culture, I don't even think we really have an excuse for not making determined efforts to bring everybody back into the fold, to give everybody a basic structure that they can rely on, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It doesn't take that much. It doesn't take that much. It really doesn't.
But you don't really. We do have a lot of learning yet to do. We do.
Yeah. And we got to deal with our fear. We got to deal with our fear, the fear of the homeless person as a druggie or as a thief or as a person with mental health issues. Sometimes some of those things are true, but we have to learn how to delineate the scary situations from those that are like Slim, where in fact there's a human being pushing that pushcart up St. Clair Avenue in the snow who is an entrepreneur at heart.
Yeah.
All he needs is a little door open. Not everybody is Slim. You know, Slim is a rare guy, but there are, and you know, he says that in the second video, is to understand everyone who's homeless is there for a different reason, you know. But there are individuals who will respond to our efforts, you know, and I think we have to try to seek some of those people out.
Wow, that is wonderful. What a great story. Oh, everybody go to YouTube and watch that video. It's really going to inspire you, and it's going to get you thinking about how you can make a difference in the world. And I think it's that same, what you're doing with homelessness and bringing that attention to that, we can basically do the same thing with peace, too. We can take an active part, our active role, because our fears actually could be stopping us from moving forward with that. We become that which we desire, which we seek. So if you want to help somebody, you're just empowering them, but you're also empowering yourself. And that's how we're all connected, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. You know, I mean, he's given me a great gift. I mean, he's, you know, I always wanted to help him. And I remember when I was writing, I kept saying, you'll help him later, because I knew it would take some energy, you know, because now, you know, initially giving the books, but now we're connected and we dialogue and, you know, and I didn't have room to dialogue much with anybody for very long, you know, and now... I am helping him because this man is somehow a part of my innate image. He is, there's just something about me and Slim, like it's sticky, like, you know, when you know there's something about you and that other one, there's some learning. He's got something for you too. It's not just what, you know, it's not just what like the guy with the house has for the homeless dude.
Yeah.
That homeless dude's got something for me too. And, you know, apart from selling books and all this stuff, there is some deeper level gratification, like he's part of my spiritual family, and I needed to somehow help to elevate his experience, you know?
Yeah, it's sticky. I love that.
Yeah, it's sticky. Me and Slim are sticky. I mean, that's really what it is. Don't misconstrue. But we, you know, in the ultimate, in the higher sense, we are, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's something between us, right?
Oh, that's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I love it. And we are almost out of time, but on the host page, on the radio host page, you see Jeff's book, Soul Shaping. If you click on that book, it goes directly to Amazon. Not to Slim yet, But if you go, it will take you to Amazon where you can purchase the book. I recommend it highly. It's a really powerful way that you need to explore all of your inner workings and your beliefs, and to get you to that place where you can start living and free yourself up. So thank you, Jeff, so much for bringing this to us. It really, it's phenomenal. And I love the story about Slim.
Right on.
And
Slim
everybody,
rocks.
Yeah, and go and visit Jeff at his Facebook page.
There's a group on Facebook called Soul, the Homelessness Challenge 2008. They can also go on the soulshaping.com website, and there's a couple of blogs about Slim, and there's a free audio pod called The Little Voice That Knows that people are listening to that is, in a way, a sort of a synopsis of the book that is really, really cuts to the heart of the matter pretty intensely.
Oh, how wonderful. Okay, so that's www.soulshaping.com. And give us your Facebook homelessness what?
There's two groups. There's a Homelessness Challenge 2008, and then there's a Soul Shaping group as well on Facebook.
Okay, excellent. Yeah. All righty. All right, so we've got all that down. Thank you so much. This has been wonderful. I knew it would be, but keep up the great work. Are you coming out with another book soon?
No. We got a movie to finish, and we got to move the book into the world.
Oh, yeah. Well, come back and talk to us about the movie, all right?
I'd love it. You got it.
Oh,
thank you so
great.
Much.
Okay. And to all of my wonderful listeners, thanks for tuning in tonight, and we'll see you next Thursday night. And remember to create from a happy place. Again, thanks, Jeff, and good night to all my wonderful listeners.
Good night.
You have been listening to the Law of Attraction Talk Radio, hosted by Jules Johnson. For more information, go to www.lawofattractiontools.com.